Hello and welcome to another episode of Shipping and Handling. I'm your host, Jennifer Udden.
And I'm your co-host, Bridget Smith.
So it's been a while. And yes.
Jen still hasn't read the book.
I still have not read the book. I did renew it at the library today, so winning. But we thought that we would do a sort of back to basics episode for you guys. Yes. Because we had a couple of asks in the inbox from some cool shades and ons who had some questions about, you know, finding an agent and vetting an agent and, you know, how to figure out if your agent is the best person for you.
So and there were a couple questions in there about CPs and how to
critique partners. Yes. In case you didn't know.
Esoteric acronyms that we have here. And so we thought we could talk about how to just basically find the right relationships for people who are working with your book. Yeah. Whether it's a critique partner, an agent, an editor, in case you are in that wonderful position of having multiple editors bid on your book. So we figured we'd delve into that issue a little bit today.
Yes. So I guess sort of pre-finding an agent, you know, the thing to do is to find a critique partner or a beta reader if you're a fanfic from the fanfic world. So what would you say are the sort of best, the qualities people should look for in a beta reader or critique partner?
First of all, willingness to read your book, which can be harder than you'd think, but also someone who is not invested in your personal happiness necessarily, not a family member or a friend. Just generally go for, or like at least not anyone who lives in the same house as you, that sort of thing. People who will be willing to tell you their honest opinion, and also people who read a lot,
yeah,
and who have thoughtful opinions about the books that they read.
Whose opinions you respect. And,
yes.
And who more or less are aligned with yours.
Yes.
And, you know, I know that there's going to be that person who's like, but my, you know, girlfriend, partner, husband, sister who I live with is a great reader. And, you know, it should be a great reader. Just if you trust your relationship enough to do that. I do know people whose, you know, spouses or partners, yeah, or siblings, like, read their work. And, like,
and some people, they're are married to their agents, and I'm including, well, your
including
boss.
My boss.
You know, you've got to have a very strong relationship to be able to be honest with each other in that way. And so if,
yeah,
you really believe that's there and they're not going to, you know, tone down some of their critiques to spare your feelings, then sure, go for it. But, you know, it's kind of along the lines of, well, my mom likes my book.
Yeah,
I'm sure she does. I believe you.
Because ultimately, you know, what you want the critique partner to do, you know, your critique partner serves the role as the audience proxy, the first audience proxy that you,
yes,
run into. And you want them to be able to give you feedback that is going to not only make the book better, but help you connect to more people as, mm-hmm, your audience grows. So if they're just like, it's good, you need
the
to
end.
Be like, but how is it good? And what parts are less good than other parts?
I need more thoughts than that. I do remember one thing a lot of people who write for children like to do is find, you know, nearby kids and have them
youths
read the books. Youths. Whether they're like actually small children in the case of picture books or like a friend's kids or, you know, neighborhood children or whatever. I actually remember I was given a manuscript to read when I was probably 12, that had been written by a friend of my parents. It was like not at all something I would have chosen to read for myself. And I remember I had very few like actual thoughts about it because I was like, yeah, it was pretty good.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know how I feel about that because on the one hand, I feel like, you know, there's a certain element of creepiness of, like, lurking outside of school being like, hey, kiddies, want to
read
my book?
Book.
You know, the white van of literature.
They always told us books were dangerous.
And the other part is, you know, I feel like when a kid reads a book, or, like, when a youth reads a book, that sort of either they were assigned or you know, they picked up on their own, their parents gave them. At least I was a very sort of like authority feelings conscious mm-hmm. child. So I yes. probably wouldn't have been honest if someone had put me in that position.
Yeah.
And because I wanted, you know, want to get the good grade. So I want to yeah. say what people want to hear. So yeah.
The other thing was when I was that age, I sort of conceived of books as things that were not changeable. Like they were handed down like the 10 commandments on stone tablets and you yeah. couldn't change them. So I didn't have any useful feedback because I didn't think of that as like, I didn't process books that way.
Yeah.
So I wasn't like, oh, you should change this character, because I was like, that character is a person, you can't change them.
Right.
They are who they are.
Yeah.
So it can be, I suppose there's not really any harm in giving it to kids, like kids you know, don't go looking for strangers, but I wouldn't rely on them
yeah.
as a primary method of getting feedback.
Yeah. And, you know, hopefully, you know, the first person, you know, your critique partner, the beta reader, the first person to read your book, basically, you want that relationship to be sort of like long, mm-hmm. you know, long lasting. You know what? You want it to go over a period of time, because if they, you know, give good feedback and say you're writing a series or something, you know, not yeah. only have they read all the previous ones, you know, they'll remember what happened, hopefully.
Sometimes they can be continuity experts for you.
Yeah. I am actually really super terrible at that for my clients' books. I'm always like, wasn't this person there? And my client has to remind me like, no, in this, you know, this is when this happened. I was like, fuck.
See, my problem is that I forget people's names like immediately.
Oh my god, me too.
So I'm like, I can,
what's her face?
I can finish a book and put it down and be like, you know, the main character.
I know. So, I was on a client call today and I was just like, the sisters. They're the fucking
those people,
main characters.
You know.
Only two point of view characters. Like such a dumbass.
It's especially hard when it's in first person though, because you don't repeat their names ever.
True.
It's like I've seen this character's name like maybe a dozen times in this yeah. book. Of course I don't remember.
That's true. That's true. Well, yeah. So, I mean, that's what because the other thing that it sort of frustrates me sometimes is that this has actually never happened to me, but I've heard stories about it for people having this with some of their clients, other agents having this problem with their clients, where, you know, they've given a client feedback on something and the client is like, well, my critique partner loved it.
Oh.
Because not only do you have to, like, appreciate that person's feedback, but you also have to know when that person's feedback is A, not working, or B, not the most important feedback right now.
Yeah. You need to understand the limits of it. And this can be why it's helpful to have multiple people.
Yeah.
It's often, I wonder about, many of my clients have critique partners who write different things, different kinds of books from them.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm always kind of curious about how those relationships work out. Because there's nothing inherently wrong with that. Your critique partners don't have to write the same kind of books as you. They don't even have to write books at all, as long as they're good readers. It would be insanely hypocritical of me to be like, the only people who can give you feedback on your books are other writers.
Yeah.
Not being a writer myself.
Yeah.
So obviously, as long as they can read your book and provide actual thoughtful notes on it, that's more important than what they write themselves.
Yeah.
But it's always something that's kind of like, oh, okay. Makes me tilt my head a little bit.
Question mark. So, you know, on that note, we do have a question pertaining to critique partners from A Cool Shades and On, which I will re-find in mm-hmm. my phone.
It's right there.
My phone is so broken, guys. It's
it's so sad.
It's really tragic. Barry keeps looking over and being like, get it fucking fixed, Jen. I'm sorry. Okay. So Cool Shades and On says, my super needy CP is driving me up a wall. I feel like I'm constantly having to talk them off a ledge. I want to be a supportive friend, but for fuck's sake, these daily meltdowns drain me. I can't get my writing done because I spend most of my time trying to keep them encouraged/motivated. I feel like, what's worse, I feel like their bad attitudes/insecurities are rubbing off on me. I love them and want to be supportive, but I can't share in their misery anymore. Is there a nice way to say, suck your shit up already?
I sympathize.
I sympathize. I think that, you know, this is where my advice is just lie. Just lie and say that you don't have anything for her to read or for them to read. There goes my efforts to keep it gender neutral. I don't know. What would you say? I'd just be like, nothing's happening here.
I do. But, like, if they keep coming back to you and still needing you to deal with their shit and you're not getting anything in return, then it's even more exhausting.
Well, this is where Mallory Ortberg / Dear Prudence would say, you need to establish boundaries.
Yes.
And there is a way to, you know, say, I want to be there for you, but I can't be there for you to the extent that you seem to need me.
Yeah.
Can I help you find, like, a therapist or something? Because it sounds like they need, like, a therapist.
Yes. The other thing you can try to do is establish limits on how often you're in touch.
Yeah.
You can say, like, I need to be able to focus on my own stuff. I can't deal with this every day. Maybe you can send me, like, one email with all of your questions, all of your worries, and I'll get back
to you. I wonder if this is sort of like a co-fic writing person, like, group, or, you know, like, co-writers, or, like, maybe they're each other's beta readers. Because that might be a little bit, it sounds like that would be a little bit more difficult to untangle.
Yes.
Because I'm invested. Trying to think of a situation where a critique partner would need to talk to you every day.
Yeah. Well, some people use it as support groups. So maybe they're, like, on submission and really stressed about having their, like, not hearing back.
And to be fair, in the past, we have suggested that people rely on their support groups for support rather than other people.
sorry about that.
Well, not we didn't mean this.
No. I think it might also be useful to just, like, I think I didn't actually have an idea there, and I just started talking, hoping one would come to me. Sorry.
It also depends on if they're sort of like IRL friends or online friends, because online you can just ghost.
Yes. I'm not here right now.
Turn your GChat status to invisible.
Yes.
And don't reply to anything. Until, you know, or set a time period when you're going to reply. Like, I will reply to you every week. Mm-hmm. And then if that person doesn't honor that, then you're just unavailable.
Yeah. Yeah,
it's really tough.
Like, really helpful.
Like, we're being a little bit glib here, but, you know, it's really, really tough, especially, you know, Bridget just, she was like, pulling her hair back with both hands, but somehow also tipped the microphone over, but then, like, caught it with her face.
I elbowed the cord, and it fell.
She caught it with, like, both her face and her wrists. It was kind of amazing.
I'm very graceful and deft.
She's beauty, and she's great. Someone put up, like, on, I think it was on Tumblr, like, she's beauty and she's grace, she'll punch you in the face, because of all the Trump stuff. But yeah, I mean, these relationships can be, you know, they're incredibly important, and it's incredibly difficult and, you know, necessary to keep them sort of honest and, you know, safe spaces and all that. And but if you feel that your critique partner is getting in the way of not only your work but your mental health and happiness, then you have our permission as internet experts to to cut that person off.
I mean, we all have this kind of relationship in our lives where it's someone who you do love dearly, but they drive you crazy. And you just can't, you start losing your own sort of equilibrium trying to deal with them,
and equilibrium is very important for all areas of your life,
especially when you're trying to write and trying to deal with all of the sort of publishing nonsense in your own life. That's hard enough to without being unbalanced by someone else. I would say try be a little less available to this person, and cultivate other relationships. You may be able to, maybe if you have other people who balance you out a little bit better, you'll be more able to be available for her.
Yeah, and more able to deal with, you know, any kind of emotional
whatever
that gets thrown your way.
Yeah.
Because, you know, one of the things I've been telling myself lately is, you know, someday we'll all be dead. Is it worth spending your time, like, worrying about this or expending energy being angry at this person? Or because ultimately, like, I will die soon. Not, like, soon, but, like, but, you know, we are all mortal. We are all mortal. So, you know, at a certain point, cutting your losses is like the healthiest thing yeah. for the long term.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we had another couple of questions on here about, you know, how to vet an agent mm-hmm. and how can you tell, one Cool Shades Anon asks, how can you tell a good agent from a bad agent, a schmagent, a fraud? One of the things that you can do is to check up on their website.
Mm-hmm.
There's some sort of red flags for me when, you know, so-and-so's lists their former job as intern.
Yeah.
Or formerly an assistant at.
Yeah.
And they're starting their own agency.
Yeah. Or if they have no experience at all in publishing, anything that's sort of like, oh, I just love books. So I thought I'd be an agent.
Yeah.
Like, not quite. There's a little bit more to it than that.
God bless. People love books. And, you know, the more people that want to get into the industry, the better. But, you know, you have to decide what's best for you.
Yes.
Another thing to do is check up. This is kind of like, I don't know, this is what I always like doing, is check on the covers of the books that they've sold. Like, if they say that they've sold books, like, are those covers of books that you would actually
pick up off the shelf and
yes. read? Like, does it look like someone did it on MS Paint or, like, bad Photoshop? Like, are they selling only to the same three small presses?
Yeah. Because if they're only selling to the same three small presses, that's where they're going to sell your book too.
Yeah. You're not going to go anywhere different. You know,
you don't want to be the one who's like, maybe I'm going to break through on this one and break this agency out. But like, you can't count on that. It's you got to go by precedent.
That's you know, that's one of the critiques that the industry rightly gets, is that, you know, people only, you know, get in if they've worked somewhere before and they only have, you know, referrals if someone knows them, and they only. But at the same time, that's the way that the industry is built. So there's really only a certain amount of maverickness that you can really go with.
Also, it is it is way easier to break in as a writer without connections than it is to break in as an agent without connections.
Yes, agents, that is 100% true.
50% of the job is who you can get to read the book.
Because publishing is so small that, you know, publishing people... We are all so busy. We really only know other publishing people.
Yes.
You know,
it's
the sad truth of life.
I did an informational interview with I keep doing that.
Good Lord. Here, I'm just going to tip it back a little bit so that it's
okay.
There.
I did an informational interview today with, you know, someone who's like newly graduated from college and going, what do I do with my life? And I was like, oh, dear sweet child, I was there 5 years ago. I remember 6 years ago now, I guess.
Happy anniversary.
Yeah. one of the questions she asked me was, how do you find your like work-life balance? How do you do that? And I was like, oh, I don't. All of my friends are in publishing.
Well, yeah.
This is like at least 3/4 of my waking hours.
Well, and it's funny, you know, I read an article a long time ago that really stuck with me, and it's by this woman, Jennifer Zura, who does the Get Bullish website. It's like sort of advice for hustling ladies. Mm. Not like how to like hustle ladies into doing stuff, but ladies who are on the hustle. And she wrote this article called Maybe Work-Life Balance Means You Need to Work More.
Mm.
Basically the idea that, you know, there's going to be periods in your life when you're unable to work as much as you need to make yourself like pay your bills.
Mm-hmm.
So if you expend more work at the beginning of your career, you sort of lay the foundation for when you need to work like 10 hours a week because you've had a kid or an injury or an illness or something.
Mm-hmm.
That you're prepared for that. So I'm sort of like, yeah, fuck work-life balance. But yeah, everyone in publishing kind of...
My response was just sort of, I just really like the people in publishing and I want to be friends with them.
That is very... I mean, that's true. You know, we all love books. Like, we're not in this... We're certainly not in this for the money.
No.
Like,
no.
Who's like, how can you make money in publishing? I'm just like...
Get a job elsewhere.
Yeah. It's like... Become Mark Cuban and write a best-selling ebook or something. Yeah,
somehow, like, magically write 50 Shades of Grey.
Yeah. But yeah, so it's... When you're looking at agents and you're looking at agencies, precedent is important. Mm-hmm. And, you know, maybe you're looking at an agency that's brand new, but that person is like, I have been an agent for 10 years. This is my new agency. I was previously at these agencies. And you can look up those agencies and see what they sold.
And this is where my boss was 15 years ago. She started her own agency after 10 years of being an agent at much more established agencies. She knew what she was doing. She had a list of clients willing to come with her. And she started an agency, and now I'm here, and I, you know, she hired me with no experience.
So yeah, so a new agency isn't necessarily like a red flag, but I think you should definitely take into account, you know, who have they sold anything? Who have they sold to?
And what have they sold?
Yeah, what have they sold? Because, you know, you may be looking at an agency and, you know, you'd be one of like three fiction clients.
Yeah.
Or one of, you know, three, you know, picture book clients. And if that's not what they do or not, that's not what they're good at. You know, is that the best place?
Yeah.
You know, that's something to really take into account. And I, you know, I have a couple of clients who are just like, you want to take me on? You have nothing like me on the list. I'm like, that is fair. That is fair criticism. And so sometimes I am put in the position where I have to sort of say, like, I have never sold anything like this before, but I love the book. And these are my ideas about it. And they have to have an idea of how they're going to sell your book and where it's going
to
fit.
That was sort of me when I was trying to get into SFF, because my boss sold one fantasy trilogy like 10 years ago, but she's not interested in the scene.
And there is a scene, which is sad.
And so she was like, well,
we went to the most rad party this weekend that was definitely like the who's who of SFF, and I felt so fancy.
It was on a carousel too, so it was even better.
It was amazing.
It was the best.
So great. Thank you, Ellen and Delia. Happy anniversary.
So when I joined here and I was like, you know, I really love fantasy and science fiction. I'd love to take some clients on that area. And there's, you know, our agency doesn't have a history in this. So I have to justify it and say, well, I started at Tor.com. I have all of these connections at Tor as a result, and those connections have gotten me connections elsewhere. I know a lot of editors.
I've been to World Fantasy. Yes. I go to the cons. I go to the parties. Like
all of these things. And like I can name someone who I would send your book to at each of the major SFF publishers.
Yeah.
And I know that like we've had lunch together. We've had drinks together. They know who I am.
Yeah.
And so I being able to that. If I we didn't have the history or the precedent, so I have to prove my own worth.
Right.
And so that's, you know, you're looking for one or the other.
Yeah. I mean, in terms of just like fraud, the out and out things to look for are pretty easy. Like, never go with anyone who asks you to pay them money.
No.
Up front.
Don't do it. Don't do it.
There should never be a situation in which you have to pay the agency anything. Except for wire transfer fees for your millions. Yes. And that's just the cost of doing business. But, you know.
And you know, that's coming out of your profits. That's
exactly.
Not like,
exactly.
You're not, you know, handing them a check. They're saying, here's your check. Here's what we deducted.
Yeah, exactly.
Enjoy your money.
And there's some websites that do a really good job of vetting people like this, like Predators and Editors and Writer Beware.
Though I will say I saw on Twitter today someone mentioning that Predators and Editors listed Random House as not recommended. So maybe
take it with a grain of salt. Yeah. It's like Random House. Really?
I think they're good. Maybe don't take their boilerplate contract, but like you can sell them a book.
That's another thing to ask about is, you know, I think it's fair to ask about, you know, do you guys have boilerplate, like negotiated? Does your agency have negotiated boilerplate with the big five?
Yep.
Because, you know, if it's the first deal that they're – if it's the first deal that I'm doing with a small press, like, it's not really a big deal. But, like, if an agency has never sold to one of the big five and they have no boilerplate ready, then I would be a little worried.
Yeah. It's
Or if the agent also does not have the experience. Because, like, an experienced agent who has, you know, worked at an agency before and seen the contracts and knows what to look for, that's not a big deal. But you know, if you get the feeling that they might not know, because you don't know.
Yep.
And if your agent is the person to know, and you had to trust them. I mean, I was in a situation a couple of weeks ago with a client where there was something in a contract, and you know, my client was like, you know, I really need this money, so like I'm willing to compromise on this, and I'm like, I'm actually really not, because this will put you in a situation down the line where you could be in trouble. And they were sweethearts, and they trusted me, and I got what we needed. But it was just like
so you sometimes need to be willing to walk away. And having an agent who knows when to say no is just as valuable as having one who can get you to a place to say yes.
I had a conversation today with a client where, you know, we were talking about possibilities for their book. And, you know, do we want to do more submissions? And, you know, I know that there are more places I could send it to, but they're not places that I really want them to have a debut from. So,
yeah.
So, you know,
like, I have a floor.
Yeah. And, you know, one of the things that is, like, the hardest thing to say that I just genuinely mean every time I say it is better to not be represented than to have a bad agent.
Yeah.
It is better to not be published than to be badly published.
Yes.
Because everything sort of creates, like, a track record, and it creates sort of a history. And then you have to overcome that history if that history isn't good.
Yeah.
So.
I have turned down offers to publish books by my clients because I looked at them and I turned to my client and I said, I can't in good conscience recommend this. And fortunately, both of them were like, yeah, no, I agree.
Yeah. And, so. And you know, you want to make sure that, you know, just like with a critique partner, that your agent has your best interests in mind. Like, they're not thinking of their own gratification. They're thinking of only insofar as they can sell your book.
Yeah.
But they're doing that for you.
Yeah.
Like, they're like, I am my client's employee, essentially.
I always feel weird about using that term because I think it is more of a partnership. If you call agents employees of writers, it means that they don't necessarily have to, like, trust your advice quite as much.
I guess that's true, but
you are, what is it, the phrase in the agency clause that we always use is coupled with an interest.
Coupled with
something.
An interest.
It basically means, like, we're both invested in this, and we both... This affects both of us, and we're working to make sure this works for both of us. And so the whole point of commission is that the better your agent does for you, the better they're doing for themselves.
Right.
but that does mean that you want someone who is willing to say, like, I don't think this is good for you. So even though it would be easy money in my pocket, I'm going to say no. Because I don't think it's going to work for us down the line.
Right. Exactly. So, yeah. So that's sort of the basic sort of, you know, I don't think that any of the questions we have are on, like, how to find an agent. But
no.
I feel like if you've found this podcast, chances are, you're doing great. So we have a million questions. Like, for some reason, in the last, 3 weeks, we have a bunch of questions. So thank you guys so much for submitting these and for hanging in there with us. We actually, I think it was a couple of weeks on Facebook. There was, you know, the Your Memories, Jen, and it was, you know, the first episode, posting that the first episode was live. So,
aww,
you know, yay. It's been great. So, okay. So we have an anonymous question that, you know, we're not really sure how to answer because we're not really sure what they mean. So if you are this cool Shades Anon, please elaborate, because I've literally never heard of this before. And the question is, what about a walkthrough of creating a writing business plan, kind of a how to get there from here sort of thing?
Are you thinking of, like, a career goals type thing?
I think that they're thinking of, like, how do I become a bestseller in 10 years kind of thing. In which case, if you fucking find out, tell me.
Yeah. No, this is, oh God. Was it Sam Sykes was talking about this? You have to, the goals you create as a writer have to be things within your control.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I was reading that on Twitter the other day.
Yeah.
It was so smart. I was like, fave.
Yeah.
I fave too many things, and then I can't find them later.
you can't say, I am going to be a bestseller in 10 years. You can say, I am going to have written this book. I'm going to have leveled up in this way. Because it's, as long as you're trying to fight against what other people are doing, like, whether it's becoming a bestseller, whether it's, you know, having whatever John Scalzi's absurd publication deal is, where it's like 10 books for $2 million, or if it's getting a movie or any of those things, those are not within your control, and it will cause you pain
when you don't get them. And you won't be able to enjoy the things you do get along
the
way. Here's a question. Would you count getting an agent on the list of things you can control? Because I think it's sort of in a gray area, because you can control how much you work on your writing and how good your writing can be. But on the same time, you can't control what people are looking for, how much time they have, you know,
whether
stuff like
they
that.
Respond to things. And so I guess the thing there, what I saw someone say was like, your goal shouldn't be, I will get an agent this year. It should be, I will send out 50 queries this year. And you can, and from that you can say, and okay, if none of those work, then I will go back and reassess my manuscript. I will reassess my query. And in the meantime, I'm working on the next thing. As long as you keep your goals within your own hands.
Right. The only thing that writers can really control is how much they write and how much they work on what they write.
Mm-hmm.
Because everything else is completely outside of your control.
Yeah.
You know, whether or not your critique partner has time to read it that week.
Yeah.
Whether or not your agent has time to read it that week. What your agent thinks of it. Whether you even have an agent. Whether editors are, like, fucked off for the month of August, as I recently found out that some people still do that. I was like, oh my God, you're amazing. Goals. You know? But, so I think that that's an important thing to keep in mind. So Cool Shades and On, if you have, like, a more specific example of what you need from that question, you know, please check back in with us because we would like to be helpful, but we do not know what to say. So another Cool Shades and On says, you've both mentioned that you read your boss's queries, and I was just curious how that worked. Do you look at the queries differently when you are considering them for something else? Do you respond yourself or pass them on? I've received a couple of responses from an agent other than the agent I queried and found it a little confusing. I'm a huge fan of your podcast. Thank you.
Hi.
Thanks for the great advice and all the fabulous book recommendations. I'm also enjoying the SH Book Club. Thank you, Anon. Yes. I actually don't read my boss's queries anymore,
which feels
like leveling up. I can tell what I used to do when I did do that.
Well, I'll talk about how we handle it. So actually, we have an assistant who now reads all of the queries first. She's still new enough that I read everything after her. It just means that I can sort of zoom through them a little faster. And if there's nothing that grabs me in the first couple of sentences and she hasn't started for me to look at, I'm like, okay. Or if it's something I'm like, we clearly do not do this, I trust that she has already looked to see if it's a referral or if there's something extra brilliant in it, and I can just pass through it. I have, after 5 years, you know, I have a pretty good sense of my boss's taste.
Yeah.
So I read through and I say, oh, I think Jenny will really like this. And I have done this a couple of times. She assigned a couple of people who queried me. And I said, actually, I think that this is really Jenny's taste. And I'm like, it's well written. It's just not working for me. But I think Jenny will like it. So I hand it off to her and say, if you like this, you can contact them. And then there are a couple of things where people queried her, and she didn't respond to it, but I really did. And actually Emma Mills is one of those people. She queried Jenny and I was like, I think this sounds amazing. And Jenny was like, I don't get it. And I was like, okay, great. I'm gonna go for it.
I do. How convenient. I do.
So basically what it means is I'm looking for basic competence first and then for which of us I think it'll appeal to.
Yeah.
And it's also, you know, the way it works is if we respond to the queries, if we're rejecting the queries, we respond for whoever sent it, it was sent to. If we're requesting it and if it was sent to Jenny and I want it, I send a request letter that says, Jenny passed this to me because she thought it would be a better fit for my taste, and vice versa. So we do, you know, send those letters from the opposite person. I can't imagine sending a pass letter from someone else. That does sound confusing.
Yeah, the only thing I can think of is that, you know, it's someone who's reading queries for their boss, and their boss is just so fancy that they don't give a shit.
Yeah.
Who signs the rejection letter.
Or, you know, they accidentally pasted the wrong one in or something.
Right, yeah. I mean, when I used to read queries for my old boss, you know, I had a pretty good idea of his taste, but really I was just kind of reading for quality because you really never know. I mean, I personally never know, like, what is going to be. So, yeah, I mean, we're sort of reading for general quality, and then, you know, it's up to our bosses to figure out if they like that quality or not.
Yeah.
So another Cool Shades and On asks, if you read and love a requested manuscript, do you ever ask anyone else in the office to read it as well? Only if I like it, but I have questions about it.
Yes.
I did this recently with a project where I was like, there's a lot of stuff that I like about this, but I can't figure out if I'm talking myself into liking it or if I like it. So we have an intern now. So I passed it along to her and I was just like, please God, tell me what to think. And she articulated a lot of the feelings that yeah. when I was reading it, I was like, yes, this is why I was sort of having issues with this book.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's really the only situation.
I now give some
maybe things. Afterwards, if I'm like, I fucking love it, I signed it, you need to read it, it's so good.
Yes, that too. Yeah, sometimes I do have people, I don't have to like get approval before I sign something. But if I have thoughts about it, or if I want someone to confirm my opinion, if I'm like, I really like this, but is it just because I like haven't read anything good in a while, or is it because I was reading it on a plane and it was like more interesting than the clouds outside? So sometimes I do ask our assistant to read things. And that way you can also, you have someone to talk out your thoughts with.
Yeah.
So if I'm like, there's something that's not quite working here, just sitting down with someone who has also read it so that you can, they, and having them say, this thing didn't quite work, and you can just have a conversation and they could say, oh yes, and this, and you say, oh, why, well, I want to fix it this way, and they say, oh, that's brilliant, Bridget,
right,
how smart you are. And then I'm like, oh great, okay.
She's just tossing her hair, you can't see it, but I mean, I think that, you know, the theme of this episode seems to be sort of like, we all talk to each other.
Yep.
Talking to each other is good. Yes. Because ultimately, you know, we're always sort of in conversation with our fellow agents and our fellow mm-hmm. you know, coworkers, because ultimately we want the books that we work on to be the ones that we are the most passionate about.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's, that sometimes means showing it to someone else in the office. Sometimes it means just keeping it to yourself.
Yeah.
Sometimes like a dragon hoarder.
I can't wait for you to, finish reading this. I need to offer on it now.
I know, right? That's why I'm very glad that, like, you know, cause I've had friends who started out at agencies where their bosses had to like approve the things that they signed,
man.
Which is literally my idea of hell, because I had pretty much free reign to build whatever kind of yep. list I wanted. And, you know, I feel like I've built a pretty great list out of that. And, but I think that if I had to sort of like wait for approval, I don't know that I would have become the agent that I am today. But.
When I first started, I would run things by my boss, and she would read like the first 5 to 10 pages or something and just be like, okay, I think the writing is good enough, or no, I think you can do better.
Yeah.
And so I remember I, when I was signing Emma Mills, this was still in that period. And first I showed her the YouTube videos. She was like, okay, yes. And then I had her read like...
She's so charming.
She's so charming. And then she read the first 2 pages, and she was like, yeah, go for it.
Yeah.
I don't need to read anymore. You should sign this.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So after researching successful queries, I've noticed that many do not include comp titles. How important are comp titles in a query? If you don't have them, it's fine. If yeah. you have them, make them good.
Yes.
Yeah, don't use Harry Potter.
Nope. If you can't figure out good ones, it's better to just leave them out.
Yeah.
Especially if it's something really high concept. Like my book, The Last Boy at St. Edith's, which is the only boy at an all-girls school tries to get kicked out. I'm like, you don't need comps for that. That stands on its own.
Right. You know, I sometimes when I teach classes at Gotham Writers Workshop, you know, this is the thing that comes up. Because, you know, I think that the instinct to have comp titles is a really good one, but... You know, they need to be comp titles that actually tell the agent something about the book. And in comparing things to the biggest books in the genre or, like, in the world, does not tell anyone anything about your book.
I also had one at, like, one editor panel that I went to. Someone said that they needed to have comp titles in the post-Borders world.
Yeah.
So things that have been something that broke out before Borders folded, it's not quite as useful.
I try not to use comp titles from, I try to use comp titles from the last like 2 years.
Yeah.
Unless it's something that was published a million years ago that was like such a big hit that, you know, it,
yeah.
that Borders, taking Borders out of the equation, you know,
doesn't, yeah.
hadn't, you know,
yeah.
done something. So that's that. Okay, so we have a multi-ask question. So sounds like someone's going through the wars. So Cool Shades and on, we're here for you. Okay.
We'll help you.
So part one, I signed with my agent 2 years ago because of her enthusiasm for my work. I had multiple offers. in parentheses, but lately it seems as though I exasperate her by existing. I'm not a needy client. I email her only when I have questions or need to update info, and that happens rarely. Yet every time I reach out to her, I feel like I'm bothering her, even when it's something benign, like at replying a funny dog pic on Twitter. Part two. I've had several editors request my work, and I'm readying those proposals. So it sounds like this is a nonfiction writer.
Yeah, it does.
But I dread sending them to her now that her initial enthusiasm is gone. I don't know what I've done or haven't done to get on her bad side, but even my writing friends have noticed it and have encouraged me to call it quits and find someone else. But if she hated working with me that much, why not drop me? I'm not currently under contract. We're not on submission. I'm writing in a different genre. Timing is perfect. Three. But I really enjoyed working with her at the start of our relationship, and my own sense of loyalty won't allow me to call it quits without at least talking to her first. But how do I start that conversation? What do I say? I feel like I'd be annoying her just by asking for phone time, and yet I don't feel comfortable letting her pitch these new books. If my friends can tell she's just not that into me anymore, no doubt her disinterest is coming through loud and clear to editors. Help?
Oh, man. I just...
I feel for you. I feel for you. I understand the situation.
I will say first, one of my clients just emailed me today. She's not quite under contract. We've agreed to the terms, but it hasn't been signed yet.
Oh my god, I hate that period. I'm just like, God, just give me the contract. We've agreed to the terms. Now we're fighting over the actual contract, and it's been four more months.
This one, we've negotiated it. I sent off approval yesterday, so we're waiting for the actual contract to sign. So she sent me an email today. Saying, like, how much do you want to hear about this? Like, I've been erring on the side of not bothering you. And I'm like, oh, dear, you could never bother me. Please loop me in whenever you want me to. I don't want you to feel like I am being bothered because my client who is under contract is, like, corresponding with me.
Yeah.
Terrible. I'm so sorry.
So, I mean, two things that I think would be useful information to know just for clarification purposes. I would like to know if, as I surmise, this person did start writing in nonfiction. Because from what I know about editors who or agents who handle nonfiction, this kind of like hands-off behavior isn't like, it's not like common, but it's not unknown. Yeah. An author that I had reached out to that was way above my pay grade. And, I was just so new that I just didn't know any better and reached out to them and said, you know, I'd like to represent you. And
they Jeff, were always try. Why not try?
And they were like, that's adorable. And then their two book deals were announced. So I was like, well, aren't you fancy? And then, you know, we had a conversation later where they were having concerns about something, these kinds of concerns that this, you know, I'm not getting emails from this person. I'm only talking to their assistant, like stuff like that. This is, but you know, then they became incredibly, incredibly successful once those books pubbed, and now their agent answers her emails.
Yes.
Like that, you know, they get responses now from their actual agent. So depending on sort of who your agent is, what level they're at, and how sort of quote-unquote fancy they are, this may just be their style.
Yeah.
That being said, you need to have a talk with them.
Yes.
And you saying, hey, you seem annoyed with me, is a good way to start the question.
Yeah.
Another question would be, are they waiting on something from you?
Yes.
Because it may be that they are waiting on something from you that maybe you talked about earlier in your career, and they think you're working on it, and you know, stuff like that.
Yeah. I would definitely, before, first of all, I would say that them not dropping you doesn't necessarily mean that they definitely want to continue working with you. It might just be that you are fairly low impact and that maybe something will work out and they're willing to keep you on the line until that happens. But also, it doesn't, the way that this correspondence has been unfolding doesn't necessarily mean that they want to get rid of you. It may just be that this is their style. So I would definitely say, hey, I would like to talk with you. I try to be low impact, but I'm worried that this isn't working out. How can we make this work better?
Well, but here's where I would come in on the side, and I don't know if I just contradicted my own advice. You know, everyone that I signed, you know, unless it's just 100% abundantly clear that our personalities are not a match,
yep,
and that it is not working, if, you know, when I've had that talk of like, oh, because I've had, you know, I've been behind on things, I haven't gotten back to things, you know, I've had that talk before, and, you know, almost always my answer has been like, yes, I absolutely still want to represent you.
Yeah.
You know, whether this person's agent would have that response and then continue not responding, I think would be a good question.
That is true.
I think that, you know, another question to answer is like, when you say that you're writing in a different genre, like, what does that mean? Does that mean that your agent does not represent the thing you are writing now?
Yeah.
Does that mean that your agent is not interested in representing the thing you're writing now? Because if they're just not going to be a fit for your career going forward, you know, then maybe you should break up with them.
Yeah.
You know, if editors are, and here's the thing, is if editors, no matter what happens, even if you leave your agent down the line, you are still going to get paid. As long as the agency is like
legit
and has, you know, has their shit together. If you and your agent break up down the line, you are still going to get paid for anything that you sell while you're with her.
Yeah. I would also say if you had multiple offers in the first place, I don't think it's going to be difficult for you to get a new agent.
And you got editors asking for your work, you know? Yep.
So I would definitely say don't just like end it out of the blue. I would say try to talk to her first, because maybe it is just a communication thing. But
I would also have a before you even like send the email saying like, hey, can we schedule a call?
Mm.
I would tell this person to sit down and make just a list of the things that they want out of their writing career.
Yeah.
Like the projects that they're most excited about writing, the ideas that they have that they're like, yes, I'm going to write this next. Because if you just go into a conversation going like, I need to figure out if you like me or not. Like, you need to know specifically like what you're going to be working on, because, you know, your agent's only going to be able to respond to the material that you give her.
But
I hope that was helpful. I mean, that sounds really fucking awful. So I'm really sorry.
I'm sorry. This might be the situation where, you know, you need to say no for the sake of your own career.
Yeah.
So don't be.
And you're in the best situation where, you know, you don't have anything under contract.
Yeah.
You know, nothing's been on submission. Nothing is under contract.
Yep.
You have no trail.
Yep. And I mean, future
agents.
That made
it sound like they're like off the grid.
I will say future agents will want to know that you signed with someone previously. And if you're, you know, resubmitting to the people who offered previously, they will know. But it's not necessarily like a black mark on you. We know that a lot of things go wrong that don't necessarily reflect badly on either person.
Exactly. Yeah.
So we'll just say, okay,
you know, you're writing stuff that they don't represent. You know, they don't have as much enthusiasm for your writing as previously, you know.
Yeah.
And we'll be able to figure that out.
Yep.
So, okay. I think we've
good
actually
luck.
Good luck. Yes. Let us know how it goes. Please report back.
Okay. Speaking of that last question and the person who had multiple offers from agents, should we talk about how to choose when you have multiple offers?
Yes, let's do that.
Okay.
You know, the situation when you have multiple offers is called, industry terms, a beauty contest. And I've been in many beauty contests in my life.
Yes.
And if I were in an actual beauty contest, I would be laughed off the stage. But in these kind of beauty contests, sometimes I win. and basically, you know, much like what we've been talking about in terms of like, you know, a critique partner and an editor, and, you know, when you're having the conversation with your agent, you want to know that they get the book, that they have concrete and specific plans for any changes that they think need to be made for the book. And they also need to have specific ideas about where they're going to sell it.
Mm-hmm.
And I almost never give like actual names of editors on the phone, but I always have an idea of like, this is how I would position this book. This is how I would pitch this book. This is how I would talk about this book to editors. These are the comp titles I see for this book.
Mm-hmm.
If they're just like, I super fucking love it and you're great, you know, it's going to work out.
Yeah, everything will be fine.
And in the few instances where I, you know, like I said earlier, there have been instances where I'm just like, this is not an area I've worked in before, but this is how I would talk about it. And, you know, these are the resources I'm going to tap to find the best editors. And this is how I'm going to go out with it. Because you, even if it's not a genre that the agent has typically done, you want to know that they have enthusiasm and a plan.
Yes. Yeah, the things I, when I wind up in one of these beauty contests, as I did today, generally what I'm trying to, how I'm trying to position myself is using, as a very smart editorial agent who has wonderful ideas about how to improve your manuscript that also completely jibe with what you want to write, but also as someone who has sold books that are similar to this and knows where to send this one.
Yeah.
And so what you're trying to get from this is whether or not the agent's suggestions for revision actually make sense to you. Mm-hmm. You can listen to them and say, actually, yeah, that sounds right. I hadn't thought of it that way, but that is a really good idea. I would like to explore that more. Saying, I think that, yes, we should send it to those places. And, oh, good, you've done that before. Let's see if we can do it again. Yeah.
Another thing that I like, you know, I don't know if this is just sort of my style, but I like to sort of start the call with, I am definitely offering. Like, this is an offer of representation, because I've actually heard that some agents, like, don't start with that.
I don't start with that.
I start with that.
I sort of, like, feel them out first, because if they turn out to be a terrible person and we don't, like, cannot speak to each other, I don't want to have officially offered already. So I generally get about halfway through the conversation. I'm like, okay, officially, I would like to say I'm offering because you seem like a reasonable, wonderful person, and I also think your book is great.
Well, see, I feel like if I love the book and I've done enough Googling on them to know that they're not like an insane bigot, you know, if they're like super awkward, you know, that's okay.
It's not the like awkwardness I'm necessarily looking for. I mean, I have never actually had a phone call with someone where I finished it and was like, no, I don't want to work with you.
I mean, I just know that I'm not always going to be, I know that people aren't always going to be their best on the phone.
Yeah.
I know that I'm not always going to connect to people on the phone the way that I would, that I do over email, the way that I do over like any other medium. Like Marika and I, you know, when we like are together, we have great conversations.
Yeah.
Like on the phone, you know, it's never quite as, you know, never quite as sparkling. I mean, and then on DM, we're just like gifts, you know, so it just,
who needs words?
I feel like if I've read the book enough that I have thought through my plan for submission, which I always have ready on the phone. Like, mm-hmm. I always have, like, almost, not quite a pitch written, but, like, an informal pitch and sort of, like, a vague idea of what editors I'm going to send it to. I always have that ready before I even offer rep. Because if I can't think of an editor to send it to, I'm not going to be offering. So setting those differences aside, it doesn't really, I think that it's important to start the call with plan, with telling people how the call is going to go.
Okay.
And this is just how I do it, where I start out the call and I say, you know, here's how I normally do these. It usually takes about 45 minutes to an hour. I want to hear about, you know, your ideas for the book. I'll tell you a little bit about, you know, my ideas for revision of the book. You can tell me a little bit about yourself. I'll tell you a little bit about the agency. And then, you know, you can ask any questions you have, and then we could talk about next steps.
Mm-hmm.
That's usually how I run it. And I think that has been really helpful for me in terms of, like, getting clients, because they're like, I appreciate that you told me what was going to happen.
Okay.
And how things were going to go. Because I think that it's very hard out there.
Yes.
And people like to know.
Yes.
But that might just be me.
Yeah. I usually start with talking about the manuscript, the things that I thought were really great about it, the things that I particularly related to, what it reminded me of, and then also...
Yeah.
So I love this. Now let's completely change it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and then, you know,
I figure that puts writers on solid footing, because they're used to talking about their books, and they know.
Well, that's why I like
asking
people to start out by talking about, you know, their books and like the idea, like where I always start with, like, where did you get the idea for this? Like, how what was the genesis of this? Cuz sometimes it's like really out there and you're like, "How the fuck did you come? This is great. Where did this come from?" But yeah, I mean, you sort of need to know that, you know, your agent is there for you, and that your agent is excited for you, and that, you know, your agent thinks that you're cool and that your work is cool, because even if you don't sort of like personally connect, like I know that I have clients that I don't like sort of personally sort of like, we're BFF. You know, there's some that I'm just like, we are work colleagues.
Yes.
But, you know, I love their, everyone I represent, I love their work.
Yep.
100% yeah. unreservedly love their work. Because you have to in this business. Mm-hmm. Because, like, God knows I've read some of these books, like, 9 times. 10 times.
Yeah.
And you have to have the enthusiasm to sort of, like, keep reading it.
Yes.
But,
yeah. But also, enthusiasm isn't always enough.
Yes. You need to have a plan. You have yep. to have enthusiasm with a plan.
Yep.
That's the Barry Goldblatt
like
way.
To execute your enthusiasm.
Exactly. Because, you know, especially if, you know, you're talking to someone who is maybe a newer agent at an mm-hmm. established agency, you know, you want to know how they're going to leverage the agency's connections, even if they don't personally have those connections. Like, how yeah. are they going to work their connections through the yeah. agency to, like, find, you know, the right home?
Yeah. Enthusiasm doesn't pay the bills. So.
Yeah. Enthusiasm yeah. and follow through.
A lot of people say that finding an agent is sort of like dating and finding someone you're going to marry. I think it's more like college applications.
Yeah.
Where you're trying to prove yourself, but then once you get to a certain point, everyone wants you. And you have to find the one that's the right fit for you based on what you want for your life, what you want for your education, the campus culture.
Yeah.
All of that sort of thing. And
with the knowledge that if you get to college and realize it's not for you, you can transfer.
Yep. Completely accurate. This is another way in which it is not like marriage. It's a lot easier to change agents than it is to get a divorce.
Oh, yeah. So much easier. So much easier. Uh-oh. And on that note, what are you reading lately, Bridget?
Well, I finished The Warrior's Apprentice, so we can talk about that soon.
Yeah, I have not finished it. I've just barely started it.
I'm also reading Spindle's End by Robin McKinley for my book club, my other book club. I recently discovered, I don't know why I didn't realize this before, considering it says it on the cover of my copy, but this book was a New York Times bestseller. And I'm like, how many people bought this book and were like, what the hell is going on? What is this? Why did I buy this book? I mean, I love this book. It's a beautiful book, but it's also super weird and, like, does not have a very firm relationship with time. So, like, this is not your typical New York Times bestseller.
I understand that.
Yeah.
I understand that. I'm trying to think of what, I know I've read Robin McKinley. I think I've read Sunshine, and I know that I've read one other.
The Blue Sword was
Blue Sword. Blue Sword. Yeah, that's what I read. Yeah.
I am also, the Blue Sword is like foundational to me. It is a deeply problematic book, but it was also like
how many things that we grew up reading are so deeply problematic.
But you know, it's one of those things that it basically saved my sanity. So I'm like, you know what, this is a problem, but like the book still is good.
Yeah.
The other thing I'm reading at the moment is Enter Title Here by I can't remember the author's name. Raul something.
Esparza?
No. Alas.
Damn it.
Okay, we'll look this up and put it in the notes.
But what is it?
It's a contemporary YA. It's either I got it from NetGalley, so it's either new or forthcoming. And it's about this girl who is, like, in a very tight race for valedictorian, and she's, like, really driven, and she wants to get to this particular college, and she's like, but I don't know, my SAT scores aren't high enough, and, like, this is going to be a problem. So she decides that what she's going to do is write a novel and get an agent, and she has an agent who is interested based on some essay she wrote for, like, HuffPo. And so she's going to have an agent, and that's going to be her special hook. And she's like, oh, crap, I don't know what normal teenagers do with their lives. So she's basically, like, trying to write her own life with an emotional arc. And so she's like, I am going to pretend to date this guy and to have, like, friends, and then I will wind up with this, like, fake emotional resonance at the end. And from my understanding, she gets, like, looking at the reviews on Goodreads, she gets basically more and more ruthless throughout the course of the novel. She doesn't have the emotional, like, arc.
So she's Becky Sharp from Vanity Fair?
Yes. So I'm really enjoying it. It's very funny. I was reading it in a bar because I went to go get on the subway a couple weeks ago or last week, and there was, you know, massive delays. And I was like, I don't want to, this is going to take me an hour to get home, or I can go to a bar and have a beer and some fries and, like, read a book and be in a good mood.
So other than sitting on the train going,
exactly.
The platform is like the seething mass of humanity, just like, why?
So I did that, and I was, like, reading this book in the bar and just kept laughing out loud. I was like, ah, yes, neighbors, I am a nerd in a bar. It's great. I recommend it.
Nice.
So I'm enjoying this book. I haven't finished it yet, so we'll see how I feel at the end of it. But for now, I think it's pretty good.
Nice. Nice.
What about you, Jen? What are you reading?
I finished rereading The Perilous Guard because I just really, really wanted to reread it. I saw it on my shelf and I was like,
yes. We read that for Sirens. That was the thing. Mm-hmm. Nice.
Yep. I love that book. It's sort of a Tamlin.
Yeah.
I always thought it was middle grade. I was like, this is definitely not middle grade.
The pre-Harry Potter children's book type thing where it's like kind of for children, but also kind of for adults.
Yeah. Yeah. They definitely like get married at the end. So spoiler alert.
I'm sort of like, how would we categorize Ella Enchanted today?
Oh, God. I have no idea.
It's probably to our detriment that we don't know how we would sell that.
Because, you know, Ella Enchanted exists. Like,
it's true.
You know, we don't need to invent the alternate universe where Ella Enchanted doesn't exist, because YA literature as it is now would not exist if it weren't for these books.
That's true.
So
yeah.
Time is a flat circle. I did not watch True Detective. But the thing that I'm actually in the middle of right now that I downloaded just sort of for like almost like a palate cleanser is this biography of Patricia Highsmith.
Oh.
And I have never read a Patricia Highsmith book in my life. I'm going to now because, you know, Talented Mr. Ripley is always, I've seen movie. Yep. It's always been on my list to read. You know, Carol came out last year.
Mm.
Patricia Highsmith was fucking crazy. It's amazing. This is the first biography written of her where the biographer has had full access to her archive.
Oh, man.
So all of her diaries, all of her, like, she kept, like, writing notebooks because she was very serious about the craft.
Mm.
But her diaries are just, like, lists of women that she's had sex with and, like, you know, things she ate or not ate because she was, I think, a little bit anorexic. And, you know, things she drank, which is everything.
Mm.
One of the interesting things early in the book was like everyone was really amazed when she died that she didn't actually die of liver damage because she drank so much that everyone was like frightened of her. But apparently doctors posited that the enormous amounts of coffee that she also drank like protected her liver, because apparently coffee is like prevents liver damage in alcoholics. And I was just like, what? I need to check their receipts on that because that is insane. But
this is actually the reason why people tell you to drink coffee when you're insanely drunk. It doesn't sober you up, but it protects your liver.
Exactly. So anyway, it's just been really, really interesting. And it's not a pleasant, like, you know, sometimes when I read biography or, you know, nonfiction, it's to hang out for a while in a place where, you know, in someone else's mind where, you know.
An interesting person. Yeah.
But she, because of the depth of sort of personal material and sort of how close this biographer got, she's such a deeply unpleasant person.
Oh, no.
Just like, but it's, but she's but like amazing, but also just like, oh my God, this is horrible. Or she would like literally meet people and be like, hey, you're a married lady. I find you hot. We're going to do it. And then she would like seduce someone and like leave them brokenhearted, or like if someone was already sort of knew that they were, you know, a little bit lesbian and were like in a partnership with someone, she would seduce both people in the relationship separately and then tell each other.
Oh no.
I was just like, oh my god, Pat, what's wrong with you?
If you're going to seduce both people in a couple, you at least need to do it together.
And she had this incredibly contentious relationship with her mother, and it's just, it's so much, but I'm really enjoying it because I'm just like, wow, this is fascinating. It's also interesting because she's sort of at the periphery of a lot of stuff that was happening in like mid-century American literature where people are like, yeah, no, I know she was in the room, but like, I can't remember anything she did. like, she was friends with Truman Capote and Tennessee Williams and, like, all these writers. But, like, she was so deeply uncomfortable in social situations that she would sort of, like, sit on the corridor, like, drinking. Like, anyway, so I'm reading that, and it's fucking wild. I'm also rereading everything that Dorothy L. Sayers ever wrote because I have to do a paper next week, and I'm not ready for it.
I feel like sometimes reading biographies like that can reassure you that all of your terrible choices are not quite so terrible. Like, I am doing better than this. Maybe not producing such works of genius, but still.
I know, there's one passage where she's like, you know, she's carrying on, you know, six or seven love affairs.
That just sounds like so six exhausting.
Six or seven. She's writing a novel. She's got a day job. She's writing several short stories at night. Oh, and another thing that this book said, which I did not know, and apparently this is not something that anyone really knew until this book came out, is that for like 7 years, Patricia Highsmith wrote like a million comic books.
Oh, wow.
She wrote incredibly extensively in the comics world and never signed her name to any of them. Apparently there's one issue somewhere that someone has like a signed like Patricia Highsmith.
Oh my God.
Like thing. But she wrote it under like pseudonyms. There's interviews with Stan Lee in this book where he's like, oh yeah, I remember her. She was such a weirdo. She was very quiet. She was a Barnard girl. You know? But it was just like, what? Man. Yeah.
Sometimes I hear about people, I'm like, how did you live? How did you do those things?
None of her writing was accepted by the New Yorker. She couldn't get a job anywhere because they were like, you were a deeply weird person and we find you uncomfortable, so we're not going to hire you. But she got a job doing scripts for comic books. Like, not even like Superman or Batman, like third, second, fourth tier superheroes. And actually, this
it's the dream.
I really highly recommend this book because this author is not only familiar with like all of her diaries and her writer's notebooks, but she's also like deeply familiar with her work. So once she sort of found out about all the comics and stuff, she basically tracked down a lot of the issues that they're pretty sure she wrote, were the ones that she wrote, and sort of like compared the themes in those books to like the themes in her fiction and there's actually a lot that's just like kind of overlapping. It's fascinating. So I'm really enjoying it.
Nice. Yeah, that sounds so really weird. Awesome.
It's sort of like fun, like subway reading. I'm just like, wow. Reading it on my cracked screen. I'm just like, okay. Well, that is probably all the time we have for today, but thank you so much for tuning in. And
for your questions.
For your questions.
We really
keep
love
them coming.
Questions.
We really do. And it's been a little bit dry for a while.
But, send us anything.
Send us anything, you know, stuff you want us to, suggestions for a book club, suggestions for, you know, topics.
And we really are going to read The Warrior's Apprentice for next time.
We really are.
I have a lot of things I want to discuss.
Yes. So,
mostly about how much I miss Cordelia.
I know. Are we going to give up on this book club before we finish the whole Four Cosigan saga? Because I really like
it is a lot of books,
you know, and also Connie Willis has a new book coming out next year. And I really want to do the Connie Willis book club. So then we can read the new one, which is the romantic comedy. So, OK, anyway, so hopefully this episode will go up with the previous episode that I have stashed that is not ready. But also I'm going to go to World Fantasy in a couple weeks and maybe possibly recording something there if things work out. Alrighty, well, thank you again for your questions and patience with us, and you know, thanks for listening.
Yeah,
see you next time.